From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We still don't know who's behind the explosions on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman that forced crews to evacuate and ratcheted up tensions already escalated after that incident a month ago when four tankers were attacked off the coast of the United Arab Emirates, the U.S. and Iran accusing each other of aggressive or destabilizing behavior in the region. NPR's Peter Kenyon joins us from Istanbul. And Peter, these explosions seem worse than the last time with crews evacuating?
Well, in a way, they're pretty similar. Explosions on board commercial ships in the Persian Gulf, disrupting the transport of products, petroleum products in this case. This time, the U.S. Navy was nearby, moved to offer assistance, as did other vessels. As you mentioned, no casualties, all hands are safe. There are also no reports of any leaks. But as you noted, something on the order of 20% of global oil consumption passes through that waterway every day. So when something happens to disrupt shipping in the Persian Gulf, a lot of people get nervous and calls for de-escalation are growing.
Well, oil prices rose almost 5% after this incident, so there has been an effect already. But just again, comparing the situations, last week, three countries submitted a report to the UN saying they thought it was likely frogmen who'd attached mines to those tankers. Again, a month ago in the UAE or off the UAE. There are reports that there were possible mines in this incident of two tankers having explosions. Do we know any more about that?
We do not. We're waiting for the evidence to come up, but there has been some speculation on that.
Yeah. Well, also speculation about why it's happening. One of the ships was a Japanese-owned ship, the other a Norwegian ship carrying oil products to Japan. Now, the Iranian foreign minister called this timing suspicious because the Japanese prime minister is in Tehran on behalf of President Trump negotiating an easing of tensions with the U.S. So just quick question, how unusual is that, that Japan is mediating? And what is your sense of the Iranians' claim?
Well, as to why Japan would mediate, it's not really acting as a full-blown mediator. Prime Minister Abe went to Tehran mainly to mark 90 years of diplomatic ties between the two countries. Now, he did offer to see if, while he was there, he could also arrange talks between Tehran and Washington so they could hash out their differences themselves. But Iran said it didn't really view Japan as the right kind of mediator at this point, so Abe lowered his goals and said he'd just try to find a way to ease tensions in the region generally. In the end, as you noted, he was in Iran in a meeting as tensions with the U.S. went the other way, going up considerably.
Yeah. Well, at last month after that incident with the four tankers, the UAE blamed an unnamed state actor. The U.S. said that was Iran. Iran denied that. And as you said, you know, U.S. ships, and we have increased visibility, military visibility in the region after the attacks a month ago. They reportedly came to the scene of this attack. Iran claims that it came and helped save these crew members. Putting aside what really happened, is there concern that, you know, if this continues, you might have the U.S. and Iranian military speeding to a very confusing situation and somehow meeting there and it not ending well?
Well, that's always the concern when American warships show up in the Persian Gulf or Iranian warships make a move out of the Strait of Hormuz. And it's a small place with a lot of hostile countries who don't like each other. And the prospect of what a lot of leaders call a war that nobody said they wanted happening anyway is certainly something to be worried about.
Yeah. I know you don't want to speculate, but I'm going to ask you to, or get the sense of how others are speculating. You know, Iran denies they are involved in this. Who else? I mean, might this be terrorism?
Speculation is focusing in a couple of directions. Let's say Iran on the one hand, or someone who wants everyone to think it was Iran. That could include regional rivals of Iran, Saudi Arabia or the UAE. It could conceivably include the U.S. or Israel. Now, we don't have any evidence of any of those people being involved at this point, but it's certainly a possibility. Mm-hmm. Washington, as you said, has blamed Iran for the first batch of attacks in May. Tehran is likely to be blamed in much of the West this time as well.
Yeah.
And it's possible it was Iran. We're going to have to see how it turns out. And there's a big question as to why as well. There could be a lot of reasons. The bottom line is why now is not all that important in a place like the Persian Gulf, one of the most sensitive flashpoints in the world.
Right.
There really is no good time for tensions to go up.
Right.
There.
And just half a minute, what happens now? I mean, President Trump tightened sanctions last month, sent a warship. What might happen now?
Well, I wouldn't want to predict how the administration's going to react. Obviously, there are voices in the administration, including National Security Advisor John Bolton, strongly advocating a hawkish Iran policy. What that means going forward after this remains to be seen. Iran is saying, let's talk. Washington has been saying the only talks they want to hold are about a tougher nuclear agreement with Iran, something the Supreme Leader says is not going to happen as long as this pressure campaign continues.
Yeah. NPR's Peter Kenyon in Istanbul. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
And back in this country, in Arizona, the trial of an aid worker charged with conspiring to harbor undocumented immigrants ended this week in a hung jury. Scott Warren, who volunteers with the group No More Deaths, was arrested in 2018 after Border Patrol agents say they saw him directing migrants toward a route to avoid law enforcement. Warren's attorneys say he didn't intend to break the law, and Warren himself put it this way.
The government's plan in the midst of this humanitarian crisis, policies to target undocumented people, refugees, and their families, prosecutions to criminalize humanitarian aid, kindness, and solidarity.
Warren is the first aid worker on Arizona's southern border to face felony charges for human smuggling in more than a decade. If he'd been convicted, he would have faced up to 20 years in prison. Let's bring in Michel Morisco from KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Tucson. Michel, welcome.
Thank you.
And you were in the courtroom for this trial. Have we learned anything more about why the jury couldn't reach a decision?
No, we haven't. You know, it comes down in a lot of ways to the same issues that have perpetuated humanitarian aid work and people dying in Arizona's deserts for going on 20 years. You know, people either have sympathy and see a real need for alternative ways and methodologies for people to have their lives saved out there, or they believe that it's the job of the U.S. Border Patrol to pick that up.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned that Warren had been accused of harboring people who had crossed the border illegally. Now, they were at a place called The Barn. Maybe you could explain that and just, you know, tell us how the prosecution tried to prove that Warren had broken the law.
So about 35 miles north of the Arizona border, there's a shelter, a refurbished old house called The Barn that was sort of used as a migrant aid station and a way station by the group No More Deaths. Scott Warren was there when these two undocumented immigrants happened to show up. He said he did not expect them to be there. But when they were, he saw that they needed some medical assistance, and he started trying to provide that over the phone from doctors and nurses that work with No More Deaths. 2 days later, the Border Patrol was surveilling this property, they said, because they had seen signs of undocumented immigrant activity in the area. And they saw Warren outside with two men pointing at two mountain ranges. This was the crux of the argument. During closing arguments, they actually tried to use the fact that he's a geography professor to show that he had a special knowledge to be able to direct people and guide them between these two mountain ranges.
In other words, to guide them away from agents who'd be looking for them.
Exactly. Yes, sir. They said to get them around a Border Patrol checkpoint. He said he was just trying to keep them from getting lost in the desert.
Warren's arrest came not soon after the former Attorney General Jeff Sessions said in 2017 that the Justice Department would be committed to prosecuting cases just like this. So this is one example of now several. How else have we seen the strategy playing out along the entire stretch of the border?
And a series of misdemeanor charges of people like Scott, including Scott himself, charged with misdemeanor crimes for littering charges, trespassing charges along the border. And then there's also cases of immigrants, of immigration attorneys and journalists who have been accompanying immigrants, asylum seekers, mind you, across the border, who themselves have been detained, harassed, photographed, surveilled by U.S. Border Patrol and CBP officers along the border.
Jeff Sessions is gone, but I assume the policy is still there?
The policy seems to not have shifted. It would be fascinating to see whether this prosecutor is supposed to meet up again July 2nd with No More Deaths attorneys. They said yesterday they will decide before that whether or not they're going to try Scott Warren again.
I guess the question is, and Michel, I'm looking at the weather forecast today, and it said it's going to be 110 degrees in the deserts of Arizona today. Is the government's policy deterring any of these groups from providing aid to the migrants as they try to make this trek north? I mean, are they still out there doing the work that got Scott Warren into trouble?
No More Deaths started in 2004, and that year we had 240 known recovered remains. We don't know how many people die every year. We just know how many are found. Last year we had 168. 88 were found around the region where Scott was arrested since the day he was arrested. These numbers haven't changed. The reality is that as migration numbers go up and down, the number of dead also do. And that seems to be the only thing that changes how many people die in Arizona's deserts every summer. And they are still doing the work, and they're saying that they're going to continue doing the work. Presumably that number would be even higher if they weren't out there. And to be honest, if the Border Patrol search, trauma, and rescue teams weren't also out there rescuing people and pulling them out of the desert.
That's Michel Morisco from KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Tucson. Michel, thanks very much.
Hey, thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
According to the American Psychological Association, one in seven women experience depression and anxiety during or after childbirth, and most find it hard to talk about. But not the LA-based comedian Angelina Spicer. She's made her experience with postpartum depression a big part of her stand-up and become an advocate for maternal mental health. KPCC's Prisca Neely has her story.
Put your hands together for Angelina Spicer!
I am Angelina Spicer. I am a comedian, an influencer, and accidental activist. Yeah.
That last thing, accidental activist, that's new and unexpected. But Spicer has testified before lawmakers in Sacramento and Washington, D.C. She talks about postpartum depression at hospitals and conferences.
I didn't plan on this journey. It chose me.
Before she became this accidental activist, Spicer was known for things like her spoofs of Tyra Banks on America's Next Top Model.
Your photo was nothing short of brilliant.
And satirical remixes of hit songs.
My style before, in hindsight, was very superficial. But it was funny.
Now, Spicer is drawing from a much deeper well, and on stage, she keeps it really real.
After you have a baby, people will tell you that your vagina just breaks. Yes, girl, it breaks. It falls apart.
Her evolution as a comedian began back when she and her husband got pregnant. She says she was happy and hopeful, but when her daughter, Ava, was born, she faced a new reality.
I thought that pushing the baby out was going to be the hardest part. Like, okay, got to do my yoga, got to get the epidural. But I was not expecting what followed.
She says everything about caring for her new daughter was just hard and scary. And she was still doing stand-up, shooting a web series. It was too much.
At 8 months postpartum, that's when everything just crumbled.
Like many new moms, Spicer struggled with sleep and stress. Her husband, Joe Trujillo, says she kept most of it inside.
If you would have been around during that time, you would not have seen that. She looked like she was holding it together.
But she was also overwhelmed by intrusive, violent thoughts. She told her therapist about this.
So I was essentially apologizing to my therapist for what I had done in my mind. That's when my therapist was like, you need to go check into a hospital.
She spent 10 days getting care at a psychiatric hospital. This was 3 years ago, but she didn't talk about it on stage until just a few months ago.
It took a while. For me, this was so shameful. Going to a psychiatric hospital?
She talks about it now because she wants to remove that shame After her hospital stay, Spicer continued therapy. She started taking antidepressants and learned how to cope.
I learned about, like, how to envision my future. And it's just a miracle now to see she's a person.
Yeah, look at a bumblebee. Mm-hmm.
Ava is 3 now, and Angelina just loves being her mom.
Ava, do you remember when you were a baby?
Yeah.
You do? Tell me about what you remember.
I remember you with your tummy.
Uh-huh, you were in my tummy. And did we go on stage and do comedy when you were in my tummy?
Yeah.
You went to the comedy
Spicer
party?
Said she didn't feel completely healed until Ava's 3rd birthday. Her husband says he's proud of her bravery in sharing her story.
She's embraced it and I think made a huge impact in a short time.
Spicer recognizes that there's a delicate balance between being funny and being insensitive. But her audiences love her act.
The response I get is like the new Me Too movement. Like, oh, finally somebody said it.
She's raising money now to shoot a comedy special as part of a documentary she's making on maternal mental health. And she's even figured out a way to combine her new message about postpartum depression, or PPD, with her classic parody approach.
You know with PPD. Yeah, you know me. You know with PPD. Yeah, you know
for Here and Now, you know I'm Priska PPD. Neely. You
know me. Who's out with PPD?
And it's time for our annual salute to graduates. So grab your loved ones for Tom Rush's Child Song. Written by Canadian Murray McLaughlin in the turbulent 60s, it's become our annual send-off for grads. A warning, grab your tissues as well. Tom once told us it was hard for him to even record this song.
It's just one of those songs that knocks you over. I had to toughen up enough that I didn't burst into tears.
Well, we read that Murray McLaughlin wrote it in the late 60s when he would have been a teen. It was literally his letter to his own parents when he left home.
For me, it's one of those songs, you know, Joni's Urge for Going will be a great song as long as winter comes. And I think Child's Song will be a great song as long as kids grow up and leave home. And I think it also works as a child of parents who are growing older and leaving us forever. Goodbye, Mama, and goodbye to you, too, Pa. Little sister, you'll have to wait a while to come along. And goodbye to this house and all its memories. We just got too old to say we're wrong. And I've got to make one last trip to my bedroom. Guess I'll have to leave some stuff behind. It's funny how the same old crooked pictures, they just don't seem the same to me tonight. There ain't no use in shedding no more tears, Ma. There ain't no use in shouting at me, Pa. I can't live no longer with your fears, Ma. I love you, but that hasn't helped at all. Cause each of us must do the things that matter. And all of us must see what we can see. Though it was long ago, you must remember, you were once as young and scared as me. And I don't know how hard it is yet, Mama, when you realize you're growing old. I know how hard it is now to be younger. I know you've tried to keep me from the cold. Thanks for all you've done, it may sound hollow. But thank you for the good times that we've known. But I must find my own road now to follow. You will all be welcome in my home. I've got my suitcase, and I must go now. I don't mind about the things you said. I'm sorry, Ma, I don't know where I'm going. Remember, little sister, look ahead. Tomorrow I'll be in some of the sunrise. Maybe I'll have someone at my side. Mama, give your love back to your husband. And Father, you have taught me well. Goodbye. And goodbye, Mama. And goodbye to you too, Pa.
And now, our salute to the graduates from our mothership, WBUR. Starting with high school, Youssef Amer, Betsy Shinatri, Lily Costa, Leo Tamagawa-Gordon, Jenny Gould, Michael Gorsi, Madeline Hartle, Fiona Keat, Julian Katsonis, Alana Liriano, Jacob Marks, Max Magus, Logan McLennan.
And our college graduates, Matthew Afiero, Sarah Barden, Brianna Becker, Jamie Klapoff, Christina Carr, Connor Jackson, Sarah Kosayan, Aiden Logan, Samantha McMahon, Noah Miller-Medson, Emma Oakes, Lexi Peary, Grace Ralbovsky, Ethan Schroeder, James Tatter, Eva Tebow, and Martin Weisgerber.
And getting advanced degrees, Clara Bauman, Jess Coughlin, Sarah Harrison, Ian Logue, and Dean Russell. Fly away all.
The founder of a popular messaging app, Telegram, says China is responsible for a massive cyber attack that disrupted its services earlier this week. It came at a sensitive time. Protesters who've been clashing with police in Hong Kong have been using the app to communicate with each other. The protesters are upset about a bill that could allow criminal suspects to be extradited back to mainland China. Organizers are calling for more marches this Sunday. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, welcome.
Hello, Peter.
So this is an interesting tech angle to a story that we've been following for a while now. But just first remind us why there were so many people who are upset about this new law in Hong Kong.
Yeah, Hong Kong Street is in eruption because the Beijing-backed government there is trying to plow through legislation that would for the first time allow extraditions to China. And protesters fear that could be used to snuff out any sort of government opposition. So the demonstrators, who've now numbered in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands, they stormed the legislative chamber on Wednesday. And all of this is happening exactly 30 years after Beijing cracked down in Tiananmen Square.
And as so often is the case these days, in a modern protest, people are using their phones, they're using social media, they're using these apps. So what was Telegram's role in these protests?
Telegram is fast. It's ubiquitous. It's anonymous. You talk about the network effects and everybody kind of signing up on this and being on it. Media, I think, has always been a lubricant for these kinds of upheavals. You could think back to the cassette tape sermons and the Iranian Revolution 40 years ago or Twitter and the Arab Spring to start this decade. When you are Hong Kong protesters living in the shadow of China's huge surveillance state, you're naturally going to rely on encrypted messaging services
right.
like Telegram to avoid detection. So China knows that and they want to crash those services.
Okay. So Telegram explained how the attack worked this way. I just read this thread on Twitter. In a sense, it says, imagine that an army of lemmings just jumped the queue at McDonald's in front of you and each is ordering a Whopper. The server is busy telling the lemmings that they came to the wrong place because, of course, Burger King is where you get a Whopper. But there are so many of them that the server can't even see you to try to take your order. So that sort of explains what happened. I guess that makes it more clear. But how did they know it was the Chinese?
Yeah, it's called analysis paralysis. The founder of Telegram, he explained on Twitter that these attacks had IP addresses coming mostly from China. I'm quoting him. Historically, all state actor-sized disruption of services of this size we experienced coincided in time with protests in Hong Kong, coordinated on Telegram. This case was not an exception, close quote.
China says that it wants this law only to extradite criminals like rapists and murderers, but the protesters say don't trust China. They'll target activists and journalists too. So if, in fact, this cyber attack originated in China, isn't that kind of proving the point that
you
the
can
Chinese
say Beijing
are behind
is,
these things?
Well, yeah, I think you could say Beijing is both haunted and guided by its experience at Tiananmen Square 30 years ago. Yes, it was brutal. Yes, CNN and others had their cameras shut off. But the moral hazard is China now, its government, its economy, its world standing have since prospered, and its billion-plus population has largely remained dormant. So that's the foremost lesson for them.
And quickly, do you think they could do something, you know, like WhatsApp in the U.S. if they wanted to? Could they target those?
I have
platforms?
No doubt. I mean, I have no doubt. Between their dominance in hardware and what they do for internet service providers everywhere around the world, the chips they make for smartphones and networks, and the government very tightly aligned with national champions like Huawei. You look at the 2016 election here. It already demonstrated how vulnerable our social networks are to nefarious behavior by foreign players.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks as always.
Take care, Peter.
Today in our continuing talks with 2020 candidates, Wayne Messam, mayor of Miramar, Florida, he fielded some early criticism, probably won't make the fundraising cut for the first debates, but is still very much in the race. Mayor Messam, welcome.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. How are you? Because you've jumped into this race and, you know, you're at the end of the pack, very low down in the polls. Why are you doing this?
It's very easy to look at the current circumstance, but the question is why the circumstances are such. Almost every candidate that has been offered an opportunity to go on a nationally televised town hall, whether it's on CNN or Fox, I think for the most part, all of them have qualified for the first debate because they have exposure to millions of Americans. My campaign has been requesting and at times demanding the same access to no success. So my hill is a lot steeper than others.
Well, and as you well know, though, you're being more scrutinized probably than ever before because you've jumped into this spotlight. So let's get at it, because you have been critical of President Trump, and we're going to give you opportunity to do that now. But that's focused the light on some of your own problems. You know, people have pointed to the fact that after you left a high-paying job in the pharmaceutical industry, you formed a construction company. There were charges that you hadn't paid an employee prior to that. FedEx sued one of your businesses. This is Messam Consulting Services in small claims court. You had to pay them a little over $3,000. You and your wife were hit with a foreclosure filing on your home. A lien from the Internal Revenue Service in 2013 against you and your wife for $32,000 and some odd unpaid 2007, 8, and 10 taxes. You have said you struggled trying to start that construction company, but what about those who would say to you, look, your track record doesn't look so great either?
I think what Americans, and actually what I know, a lot of what you brought out is very old news. Back from the early years of being in business, I'm actually an American success story. My construction management company is one of the fastest growing minority construction management companies in Florida. You can start a business. I almost lost it all. Mm. It's no secret.
This is in the recession.
Yeah, we started a construction company during the recession. We used our savings and basically paid our employees to keep our company afloat. So I stand by that record. And I think that inspires Americans to see that they have someone perhaps who have not been born with a silver spoon. And when you think about, I've always defied the odds. My parents are from Manchester, Jamaica. My father was a contract sugarcane cutter that came to this country seasonally for over a decade. Then my father, when he became a permanent resident, one of my mother's first jobs was as a cook to go out in those very same farm fields to feed the migrant workers out there.
Well, and what do you think of President Trump's proposal to prioritize highly educated immigrants in the visa system?
I think that would be a travesty, because obviously if that process was in place when my parents were knocking on the doors of this nation, they would be at the bottom of the list. I feel that this nation should open its doors to any person that would like to contribute to this society.
Let me ask you, so you have this thriving now construction company, and you are a mayor who's tried to increase development in Miramar. First of all, are you pledged to a kind of, you know, no conflict of interest guarantee?
Oh, of course. I don't do business with my city. Our laws and our ordinances prohibit that.
But what about, you know, even construction, period, at this point? I mean, look at the area east of you along the coast, where people are wondering if the answer is less development because of the rising seas. What are your thoughts about what Florida needs to do because of climate
change?
Well,
there's two things, Jermaine. It's not – construction will always be needed. You will always need to renovate projects. Most of my work is putting in more high-efficient energy systems. But climate change is something that is very real. I know in Florida, sea level rise is a big issue. But in the heartland of this country, it's impacting farming production. In the West, we're seeing fires that are just destroying property and destroying lives. And we have to become more resilient. And we must make our way to 100% renewable energy and a real plan to transition us there.
A couple questions. Are you for the Green New Deal legislation that is in the House right now? And also, how do you talk to those people in the Midwest, many of whom have been told the narrative that, you know, what this Green Deal means is they can't have cows anymore because they make methane? I mean, it's been sort of distilled into this kind of false narrative. What do you say to them, people who say, I'm afraid of what you mean when you talk about confronting climate change? I'm afraid of what it's going to do to me in the Midwest.
Well, I think what the issue is that we have to define what the problem is and come up with practical solutions. In terms of the Green New Deal, I support the urgency and the end goal of the Green New Deal. I would look to work with our climatologists, economists, to propose my own plan and how we would meet those goals.
Can you pick out one part of the Green Deal or one part of what you propose should be done to avoid this climate catastrophe that's coming? One part that you would present to someone who is worried. I mean, they're afraid that your plan for it just is not going to be good for them.
Well, one thing I would say is this. When you think about the flooding that takes place because of more torrential weather events that we're having, which can be directly connected to climate change, is coming up with an infrastructure bill that prioritizes resiliency. Whether it's fortifying our bridges, levees, dams. The next thing I will say is that we have to transition off of our dependency on fossil fuel by committing resources to renewable energy. And then we take it to these communities that could have an impact because they have some industry tied to fossil fuel, and retooling and retraining those individuals and providing opportunities to advance renewable energy in those sectors of the country. Then now people can now see where they can transition off maybe a job, and we still are acting on climate change.
Wayne Messam, again, mayor of Miramar, Florida. How do you counter President Trump's argument that poverty, joblessness among African Americans has reached its lowest rate ever? And same with Hispanics. How do you counter that?
Well, I think that's a misnomer. Average everyday individuals, especially in the communities that you just mentioned, many individuals are working more than one job. When you think about the quality of life of working those multiple jobs, it impacts the family structure. It impacts the ability to do other things that you would like to do. It's no question that this economy has continued to show some economic progress, stemming even from when President Obama was in office. But when you really think about it, who's primarily benefiting off the Trump economy? It's the large and major corporations. It's the wealthiest of Americans. The benefit has not trickled down to most hardworking Americans. And that's how I gauge the health of this economy.
Well, it's hard to argue, though, the unemployment rates that have fallen. But you're arguing that.
But what are the quality of the jobs?
The wages
what are the quality
risen, right?
of the jobs? Wages have not kept up with the cost of living.
Mr. Mayor, Where would you position yourself on this wide spectrum now of Democratic candidates? You have Joe Biden, considered a moderate, and some of the candidates have said kind of old school. You have Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren in second and third place, jockeying there, considered very progressive. Sanders calls himself a social Democrat. Where does Wayne Messam fall?
I fall as a progressive mayor that has passed the living wage in my city. I'm standing before you as a business owner that knows how to create jobs. In fact, I was the first candidate that proposed student loan debt forgiveness, the $1.5 trillion in outstanding student loan debt. Mm-hmm. But other candidates have stolen my idea. They're not as aggressive, propose their own plans, which is fine. But I led on that issue. The question is, why hasn't the mayor from a swing state, the first African-American mayor of my city, and I've asked and I've demanded, I'm a town hall, have not gotten it.
Hmm.
Other campaigns have launched since my campaign, all white males, and they were granted CNN town halls. And many of them are not very known, are not nationally known. So the question is, why?
Well, we are happy to give you this real estate here today. And I would only add that you're also that former Florida State football player briefing the NFL. You could just like run through lines, I would imagine, if they're in your way. So we're happy to give you this time today, and we'll keep an eye on you, Mayor Wayne Messam. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And all our candidates' conversations so far are at HereNow.org.
And an update on a story we've been covering this week, the shooting of former Boston Red Sox player David Ortiz in Santo Domingo on Sunday night. Authorities in the Dominican Republic say they've now detained six suspects, including the alleged gunman. Police are also pursuing four other suspects in connection with the shooting. At a press conference yesterday, authorities said the man who coordinated the attack was offered an $8,000 bounty to carry it out. They have not released information about a possible motive or who hired that gunman. Meanwhile, David Ortiz remains in intensive care at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. His wife, Tiffany Ortiz, says he's making good progress. We will continue to follow that progress and the investigation. And now a story about golf, but not about Tiger Woods, who is sure to generate a lot of attention at the U.S. Open starting today in Pebble Beach, California. There is another golfer quietly gobbling up major championships the way Woods once did. American Brooks Koepka has won four majors since 2017, and if he wins this week at Pebble Beach, he'll be only the second man to win three straight U.S. Opens. Koepka's stoic demeanor has helped keep him under the radar, but as NPR's Tom Goldman reports, that will change if he keeps playing this well at the game's most important events.
Brooks Koepka once told an interviewer, if he could do it over again, he'd play baseball. Indeed, he walks a golf course with a ballplayer's swagger, all hips and cool. There's a hint of Clint Eastwood in his steely eyes. But for all his non-emoting and certainty on a golf course, and more to the point, during major championships, Koepka insists he's just a regular guy.
I view myself completely differently than people view me. I still think it's weird when, you know, I walk into a place and, you know, I can see eyes are on me, you know, just for dinner. And I'm like, what's everybody staring at?
Oh. It's a Koepka coronation.
With his win at last month's PGA Championship, as heard on CBS, what everyone is staring at is an elite athlete who continues to make something very hard look very easy. Golf's majors are like Super Bowls, says PGA player Jordan Spieth. The best players, toughest courses, grandest traditions. Spieth won a cluster of them a few years ago. He gets annoyed when people say Koepka merely is having a run of hot golf.
Yeah, I hate the word runs. I'd said this back in 2015, 16, or whatever, when people were saying that about me on runs. It's like, no, this is who he is, and he's going to be a force to be reckoned with for, you know, decades. So get used to it.
Koepka is not some wunderkind. At 29, he's a wunder older guy who early in his career gained a lot of experience and confidence playing all over the world. He doesn't lead a bunch of statistical categories on the PGA Tour, but he's developed a knack for hitting his booming, accurate drives and sinking the biggest putts in those Super Bowls. He's only won 6 PGA Tour events. 4 of them are majors, and he's learning as he goes along from his clutch putting during last year's U.S. Open victory.
I think that was kind of the first aha moment for me of, okay, I can make putts when I really need to.
To his final round performance at last month's PGA, when he forced himself to stay positive after losing a huge lead.
I was actually really proud of myself the way I spun that mentally.
Turning negative into positive has become one of his most effective weapons, to the point he seeks the negative. Koepka has turned the classic athlete's chip on the shoulder into an art. When alerted on Twitter that a pre-US Open TV promo didn't include him, Koepka was on it.
Then I just clicked on the link and saw it and watched it. And just kind of shocked. So I don't know. I don't know. Somebody probably got fired over it or should. I don't know.
For the record, Fox Sports reportedly made 4 promos. He was prominent in 3 of them.
Brooks, one more back here.
Thanks, Brooks.
Fans here at Pebble Beach have swarmed Koepka for autographs this week. 23-year-old Troy Maxitopoulos loves Koepka's style.
He's just got swag. I think he's got it very under control. Nothing fazes him.
But doesn't Maxitopoulos miss the emotion from Koepka, the celebratory Tiger Woods-like uppercuts that fire up the fans?
I don't personally need the engagement. I like to just, you know, be a witness to greatness. I'll do the celebrating for him.
Late Sunday, he may be called upon. The buzz as this tournament gets underway is that Koepka's power and distance may not be as effective on Pebble Beach's tricky sloping course with its narrow fairways and small greens. That murmur of doubt probably is all the slight Brooks Koepka needs. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Pebble Beach.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.